Today is Monday, September 9th, and you're listening to The Job. This is The Job, a talk show about art, design, music, business, culture, and the beautiful city of Portland. I'm your host, Ray Briglib. And our guest on episode 28 is me. I'm the guest. Join to listen to me. Oh boy. But first, let's talk to our studio director, Candace. Hi, Candace.
Ray.
Yeah. Hello. I know. I'm
happy to see you.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Recording in the new studio. Yeah, so it's been a pretty incredible week here. Mostly spent looking out the windows and seeing what goes by. Oh, but you know what you missed this morning?
What did I miss?
Basically an episode from The Birds.
It's why?
Like, I looked up and there were just a bunch of birds on the skylight scratching.
Oh, I thought you meant like in the studio. Oh.
No.
That's weird.
No, but just so you know, skylight does mean there can be birds just scratching around up there.
Looking for food.
Waka!
Were they?
I don't know what they were doing.
Well, that's fine.
Sure. Our new buddies.
We got a fridge. I am so tired.
Power. You can do this.
Okay.
You can do this, Ray.
Right.
We hit so many amazing places in Portland this weekend. We had guests from out of town.
Right.
And it was our goal to give
hit
them
Masu
a whirlwind
Sushi. We hit
tour.
The farm. We hit
Farmer's Market.
Farmer's Market. Yeah, that was
Cheese
nice.
Bar.
Mm-hmm.
We ate so well. It is. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean, not well, like, healthy for your body well, but well, like, my soul is so happy. And now I should eat fruit for a week straight.
Vegetables.
Vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell that to our kid, too.
Proof that you can survive on bread alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, let's see. So we had our little celebration dinner last night at the farm that we moved.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a thank you thing for everyone for putting up with the move and helping out. That was cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
We've been enjoying our new neighbors. We got some architects for neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara downstairs. She's cool.
Yeah, there's a front desk person. That's new. Every day when I walk in, she smiles and greets me.
Yeah.
I love it.
That is nice. Birds. We've continued to evaluate our website building strategy, would you say? Can we get into that?
Do you want to?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We're mad at Woo Themes right now, so we're taking a step back from all of that.
I wouldn't say mad, but we've discovered some things that could be better about the WooCommerce, and we're willing to fix them, but they're not accepting third-party developers right now, so there's no way to...
It's not true. You could sell plugins anywhere.
Okay, then that's an option.
I'm just saying I don't feel like that's the reason. I feel like the reason is that for me, it's that I'm really struggling with the difficulty in developing websites with that whole process using WordPress and everything. It's just gotten messy, and I feel like... Yeah.
For me, there's just something where, as someone who works with clients day in and day out, that actually has the conversations with them, and I think that this happens a lot between like developers and people that are like sitting face to face with human beings talking about how they do things.
Right.
That that sometimes I think it's really easy if you don't spend enough time just working with people that are using your products. To kind of be insulated from their needs. So the particular, I think I can say this, so the particular sure. situation is that we made a really nice website for a client, and they were really happy with it on WooCommerce. And they came back to us and said, so where do I make the report that just tells me like what I sold last week?
Right. Like a pick list or something, yeah, you might just, call it. Just, yeah.
A list of what I sold mm-hmm. in a given period of time. And who's like, oh, I'll find that right for you. And it's just not there. It's surprisingly, it's just not part of it. And you know, it seems like a pretty basic need, just mm-hmm. what sold. And, you know, and in discussing this with them, you know, there's a lot of, like, I feel like there's a lot that's being copied and pasted, like, you know, you know, there's just not, there's, and I know as a programmer, it's really hard to step back and say, you know, I bet that is a pretty basic need. Yeah, we just haven't done it yet. That's fine. But this kind of like, it's being treated like as this like outlier of like, wow, well, that doesn't come up often. Like, how could that not come up often? It's, I don't know.
No, yeah. I think also part of it is I'm feeling like we're starting to lose control of the stack, I guess you'd say, the whole, the big picture of the framework. Let's just say that, like, so when we're building these sites, it's kind of built on the basic database and PHP and stuff. On top of that is WordPress, and it has its whole set of assumptions that it's at heart a blogging platform. But then on top of that, you have an e-commerce platform that is in theory open source, but its development is controlled by a company mm-hmm. who then, for all of the features that you need, you end up buying plugins and dealing with a half a dozen licenses and stuff. And at some point it's like, I feel like we're doing a disservice to our clients and that we're not controlling our fate enough. That if we're going to go to all the trouble of having this stack of resources and components that work together, that we need to, especially if we're using 90% that same set of tools on every right. site, we yeah. should have complete control over the whole thing, top to bottom. Everything on it should be either something that's open source, 100%, or something that we made. And that is totally doable, especially if we use something that has the other tools that we've considered have much better processes for development and are much more enjoyable to work with. This is getting really cumbersome and frustrating. I'm tired of dealing with some of these vendors.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. It's, I mean, I guess that's why we're constantly evaluating our tools, what we're doing, said, we want to just keep making the best decisions for our clients at all times. I think one of the things is that WooCommerce has changed their pricing a bit. So now instead of buying a license and then you get upgrades forever, that you buy a license and then each year you pay for the license again half. So it's half, but you know, there are certain projects of ours that end up having like 8 to 10 plugins, mm-hmm. and some plugins are like $99 and some are $29. But if, you know, the average is say 50 and they have 10, that, you know, that's still them paying another $250 a year to keep up their licenses. And that's not, you know, that's not astronomical, but it also, you start to think, am I, you know, you want to make sure that you're giving the best advice. Mm-hmm. And so then if this is happening, then it's no longer true that this is an e-commerce method without yearly licensing fees. They're built in to the plugins, but so many of the plugins are necessary, you know. Like, there's so many of them that's like, I don't see it as a workable item without them.
Yeah.
And so there's no way to just say, you just won't use any of these. So that, you know, becomes a part of it. But that's changed a little bit for me too, because I have to start thinking about that as an ongoing licensing fee. And I totally understand why they're doing it, but it does change the game a little bit for us.
For me, it's almost, it's the licensing fees, that's one thing. But I'm seeing that, like, the idea behind all of this when we started it was that it was open source and that we controlled our fate. But when you start dealing with a number of proprietary plugins, then it's like, you don't really, they're not really open source. Mm-hmm. They are in name, but it's like, they start not working together, and then it's like, well, if you start wanting to change them, then you're paying a license for something you're not even using or that you fixed, and that you're yeah. it starts to prevent you from building the best possible website, and then you end up just building the possible website. And I would rather take a step back and, if necessary, take some features out of what we're doing or rethink some things so that we're actually able to make the best decisions for our clients rather than having to work around this narrow field of options, you mm-hmm. know.
Onward.
Onward and upward.
Yeah, always. Feels good.
Yeah.
You know, it actually, for me, it feels good to have a business where we're constantly making those kind of evaluations and just saying what is best for our clients instead of just, like, you know, digging our heels in and saying we develop in this platform always and we're just gonna, you know, hold on to it. It's like that's been something that Needmore has always done, is evaluate what's going on right now and what the best possible recommendation is. You know, I'm glad that we're keeping that up.
I put a quote in the chat room today that I thought was very relevant to that. I think it was from Jeff Bezos of Amazon. He said, mm-hmm. all businesses need to be young forever. If your customer base ages with you, you're Woolworths. The number one rule has to be don't be boring. And I think I totally agree with what he's saying. It's like we started out making our own content management thing in PHP, and doing Flash sites. Then we built a CMS framework for Flash. Then for a while we were building an expression engine. For a while we were building in Drupal. For a while we were building in WordPress. For a while we were building things custom in Rails. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've used at least half a dozen different solutions in the 9 years we've been together, which means, on average, one of them only lasts a year and a half.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we're always looking for the... To me, I'm always looking for, like, what's going to make it the easiest for our customer, for our clients to keep their sites updated and maintained. Some of it we help with, but mostly they need to go in at any time they want and add.
I think that's one of like a dozen things that I'm thinking about, because it's like some
cases.
Probably
because I spend so much more time talking to people about their implementation. But I also see that some frameworks seem to make it easier than others for good design to come out of it.
Right.
You know, like I've seen some that I feel like we're just spending a bunch of time stripping out and fighting against.
Right.
And that doesn't feel good. You know, I'm sure there's a lot more going on behind the scenes, but those are the two places that I end up being really aware of.
Yeah.
And really, for design, I have to say that it's always seemed like the Rails sites that were the most design-friendly, and maybe it's just because you're starting with, I don't know, Scratch, or I'm not sure, but...
No, it's basically true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Because it is also the most, it's interesting. I'll have a discussion with Dan about that sometime on the air, mm-hmm. because Dan is just kind of learning Rails right now, mm-hmm. and I think it'll be interesting to see his perspective on, if he can ever get the damn thing installed, to see his perspective on some of these things. Because for me, early on we were using Rails, and I felt that way too, exactly mm-hmm. how you do, that it was the most design-friendly, mm-hmm. yet also the most nerdy. And I think that over the years, I've used a lot of different systems with varying degrees of compromise, and I am excited to see what it'll be like to try doing something else on Rails, because we have something coming up, and to see if what I remember of that is true, or if I'm just, you know, glamorizing the past, you know. So, yeah, we're going to try out a little pet project, see how that goes. Our guest on the show this week is me. Candace here interviews me about some of the stuff that's happened to me and some of the stuff I've done and some of the things I think and some of the stuff that I do. So I hope you enjoy it. Bye, Candace.
Bye.
Hi, good.
Good. So
it's great to be on the show. Long time listener, first time caller.
So why don't you start by telling us where you grew up?
Where I grew up. Kind of grew up outside of Cleveland in Sheffield Lake, but in the middle of fifth grade or sixth grade. My dad's job required that we move to Minnesota. He worked for 3M, and that is Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, home base in Minnesota. So we moved to White Bear Lake, which is a suburb of St. Paul, which is a twin city to Minneapolis. So I kind of felt like I grew up in Minneapolis, but I do have fond memories of Sheffield Lake, Ohio. Mm-hmm.
Is Sheffield where you had, you've talked before about spending some childhood time running around in the woods?
It was cool because we had this vacant lot right next to our house, and it was big, and it was probably the size of, and this was kind of in the suburbs, so it was it extended what would have been probably 12 houses, you know? Mm-hmm. I have no idea what that equals in measurement. And then at the end of that, so it was right next door to our house. And then that ended at a railroad track. So that was sort of the boundary of where I could play. It was never really said that how far I could go, but it was once I was in that woods, you know, there was nothing more dangerous than, you know, maybe an occasional deer. It wasn't a dangerous woods. It was...
And a hobo every once in a while.
No. It's the nice thing about the suburbs. There's no hobos.
On the railroad tracks?
Yeah, no, they wouldn't. The only thing that ever came down those railroad tracks, as far as I could tell, was coal. Mm-hmm. Not even boxcars. They were coal-holding cars or whatever.
Okay.
I'd get so excited, too. I would pick up stray bits of coal from the sides of the tracks.
Did you have a coal collection?
I did. My parents used to joke that if I was bad, they would give me coal for Christmas. But then that would make me happy, so they wouldn't know what to give me.
Anyway. So you moved to the Twin Cities area. Yeah. And is that where you stayed through high school?
Yeah, through high school, yeah. Okay. So, yeah. I finished kind of a half year of elementary school and then went to junior high and then high school. And it was weird because our house was... Right across from the high school was split into two high schools. So the last 2 years, it was right across from my house. The first 2 years of high school.
Dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. Freshman and sophomore years were at what they called the North Campus, which was way at the other end of town. Mm-hmm. And then, so I think maybe that's where, the junior high was right next to that. So for most of my high school and junior high career, I was very far from school and safe from most forms of mischief. And then as soon as I was a junior, as soon as 11th grade came, my grades dropped precipitously because I could basically sneak out and just go home and have lunch there. And then I'd be I'm home. I might as well just play on my computer or whatever, you know.
And what were you doing on computers then? I mean, what was possible back in that stone age of computer days?
Well... I feel like my first memory of What I could do with a home computer that was cool was we made this thing when I was in fifth grade. And this was actually before we moved to Minnesota. So this was in Ohio. We had like an Atari 400. It had like a flat membrane keyboard. It was kind of like typing on an iPad, but more difficult. Mm-hmm. And my dad made this little thing that like said like the school mascot, like in blinking letters, and brought it to like show your class day. Like every dad would come and do something cool. And my dad... But he used to bring home spare equipment from work all the time, especially once we moved to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So our basement was filled with crap, like old CRT displays, even old at that time, or like old, you know, keyboards with like just ribbon connectors that you could kind of plug into a circuit board. And so he'd always show me like, oh, you could kind of hook these up together. And he had like weird arrangements with his buddies where he'd trade for like these old machines. Like we had a pachinko machine and like all these old things that had like sort of the electro, you know, they were kind of electric, not necessarily electronic, but he used to love to tinker with that stuff. And so of course, I mean, we'd go down there and he'd just be like, here's a bucket of ball bearings, play with this, you know. Or I think for a while we had like a model train set, but like by the time I was in high school, I was still using, well, okay. So in junior high, it was still the old 8-bit Ataris. And then in high school, it switched to the 16-bit Ataris. And what was cool then is that you could, like, play cooler games or go online. And this is before the internet was, like, a realistic option for me. Mm-hmm.
What about what year are you talking about now?
Well, this is in the late 80s.
Okay. Yeah.
So you go on to, like, a bulletin board system, they were called a BBS, and you would, like, when you emailed back then, it was like you'd send an email, and then at some point during the next 24 hours, that BBS would phone another BBS and send the emails that were supposed to go there. It was kind of like the internet now, but like a million times slower. Anyway.
And
could do that.
Who would you email? I mean,
just
what?
Absolutely random, like, people. I don't even, I mean, it was like
anyone you could reach.
Yeah, literally anyone you could find. I think one of my buddies online was like really into horses, and he ran this like equestrian BBS. And I was really into William S. Burroughs, so I ran this Sugar Skull BBS. And it was like I could only do it at night, and I had to like go up every night and manually disconnect all the phones.
But your parents loved that.
Oh my God. And I'd always forget to reconnect them.
Of course.
So this important 8 a.m. phone call. Anyway, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so high
got
school.
Got through two questions.
high school, what, you've mentioned before that you spent a lot of your high school time involved in extracurricular activities versus probably like the classes. What were your big interests?
Drama, theater. I ran an underground paper called Rainy Day Weather. I was really into computers. I excelled at the computer classes, and I would sometimes go into the computer lab, although my computer was better than the ones at school, so I didn't spend a lot of time there. I was in a band in the last few years of high school. I guess that was kind of extracurricular.
Hey, you've been in quite a few bands.
I have.
Yeah. What, tell us about that.
Well, I play guitar. I don't know. I mean, I just, that was like my creative outlet for a long time, was like playing music. And I was also, of course, fascinated with the technology. So I always had like this little Tascam 4-track, which would just record on a cassette tape, so it always sounded terrible. And I just really liked playing and writing songs. I was always fascinated by the songwriting process, and I would always try to diagram songs, which is kind of how I used to write programs. I would like kind of diagram the way it should work together and then like fill in the blanks. So yeah, I don't know.
Okay, so this is one from the audience. You are both a designer and a developer. You have been. And it oftentimes takes like a certain kind of mindset to either design or develop, but you seem to be able to marry the two. What do you think it is about you that that allows you to do that, or where?
So I think a lot of people view design and development as like left brain versus right brain.
That is exactly what the that was the exact question. Yeah, totally.
So first of all, that is not true, and I'll get to that.
Okay.
But I never thought of myself as being into design until fairly late in my life so far. So I was a late bloomer in design. I was always into computers and nerding out on them. And that was probably because I had this affinity with my father, who was into that too, and it was easy to work on that stuff. He wasn't a person who thought about graphic design or anything like that. But I can remember being fascinated by motion graphics and logos on TV and stuff like that. I would love to wait for the little interstitials that happen at the beginning and ends of shows and stuff. And I would just be fascinated when like a network would change their logo animation. Like, why did they do that? And then I can remember, I remember in ninth grade, maybe in computer class, everyone was in charge of making a little movie, and it was on like an Apple II. It was on a very primitive computer. And I decided the only way to do it would be to draw out each frame, which was, I believe, 40 by 24 pixels, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I meticulously animated this whole thing and turned it into like data statements. But I was really fascinated back then with like how you would animate something and do something visual with so few pixels, with really rough building blocks. It was like working with Legos to make fine art. But then, it wasn't until I was in Santa Cruz. This was like, I spent a year in Santa Cruz before settling in Portland. And I worked at a game company, an ill-fated game company called Osiris Studios. And my job there was just chance. I knew somebody there and I just wanted a job. And it was like, well, you could probably do the texture mapping on the surfaces of the polygons in this game. So I did. And while I was there, with what little money I came by, I discovered that the section of the bookstore in Santa Cruz that I liked the most was the design magazine. So I remember there being a design magazine from Portland called Plasm that I was really into. And the work of like David Carson, who was doing really crazy stuff with graphic design. And I remember thinking, graphic design, that's what that's called. I love that. I love graphic design. And so the web was extremely nascent because this was like probably 98. So it had only really been around in any popular means for like 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't really do much. Like the predominant web browser was still Netscape Navigator. This was so long ago. Yeah, like you could only really animate by using animated GIFs. So I did. I did a like this ridiculously massive site, which I still have somewhere, that was just like, it was just stupid. But then I moved to Portland and I decided to try to see if I could get a job with Plasm, which of course I didn't. I didn't have any portfolio or anything. I think they all but laughed me out of the building, like, this isn't really a portfolio.
This is an animated GIF.
Yeah, I was like, I think I'd printed some stuff out, but it was the work of someone who just wanted to look like David Carson. Mm-hmm. I had no identity or thought of my own. And so I kind of put that aside for a couple of years, but then I was still playing around with it in my spare time, still obsessed with graphic design, realizing that this was coming together with both of my interests were coming together. And it's always seemed to me that programming is more of a creative pursuit than most people think of. I think it's a lot like creative writing. And I think that good graphic design takes a lot of rigor and a lot of like thinking about more than just, you know, it all goes back to like being fascinated by the latest NBC logo. I always wanted to know why they did it and what, like whose job it was to think about that stuff. And if they were making more money as a result of changing their logo or whatever.
So you mentioned when you went into that interview that you showed a portfolio that didn't really have your own voice.
Right.
How did you find your voice?
Well, I stopped looking at David Carson's work for one thing. Mm-hmm. I think that I got a... I think it was the Meg's book, like the History of Graphic Design, Volume 3. I think we still have it on the shelf. It's just this massive hardcover book that goes through the history of graphic design, obviously, mm-hmm. hence the name. And looking through that book was the first time, because I had no schooling in graphic design, it was the first time I had a sense of like perspective and like, it was the first time that I got a sense of like, oh yeah, this has been done before, this has been done before, and could identify the periods that I was really interested in and then could learn more about those. And I think as a result, I realized that I was really into like the real rational graphics of like Bauhaus or like if you look in like the 60s and 70s, like Olympic signage design and stuff. I realized that I'm always fascinated by the underlying structures of things. Like I remember when like grid structures became a thing on the web, being fascinated by that, or like every time someone, you know, when Apple came out with new iOS 7 stuff, I was like, they have this, they're showing you the grid structure they're using to make the icons. And aesthetically you might not agree with it, but I love learning about like the underlying, well, almost like the math behind the design, mm-hmm. you know, or the geometry anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting. From the way you describe it, it's hard to think of someone separating out design and production.
I'm biased because I'm always trying to justify that, you know, to myself yeah. and to others. Like, well, how can that person be programming and also designing? But it's like I've been doing it for so long. To me, it seems like it's an asset to be thinking about both things at the same time, you know. Mm-hmm.
So you also took a foray into coffee,
right?
Along the way.
Well, so before founding Needmore, I worked at Stumptown Coffee Roasters. Mm-hmm. That was the seventh coffee shop that I worked at. Before leaving the Twin Cities, I worked at numerous coffee shops in St. Paul and Minneapolis. Culminating in one that I co-owned with my friend Scott. And I felt like I was moving forward, kind of going from just a coffee jerk to a coffee jerk who owns the business.
Mm-hmm. Is that a technical term?
I don't know. That's what everyone called you. I'm not sure when I knew what the word barista even meant, but I think at some point I just had to get out of the Twin Cities. It was so depressing. Mm-hmm. I think one winter I just snapped. I was like, I have to go to the West Coast. For some reason, I just always wanted to be in the West Coast. So I did end up in Santa Cruz, and I had that nice computer job. But when I came back to Portland and decided to settle here, I think the first real job that I got here was at a coffee house that was in Powell's Technical Books, which I loved. Because it was a failed business. There was never any customers. No one wanted coffee. So I just sat and read technical books all day for free. I was in heaven. And then I decided, well, okay, maybe the coffee is for me. So I worked at Pete's, and I worked with Dwayne Sorensen at mm-hmm. Pete's. And at some point, we started hanging around, drinking and stuff. And he was like, hey, I'm opening a coffee shop. You should come work with me. So I said, sure, I would love to. How soon can I start? And he's like, well, I'm not opening for a couple of months. So I don't know. Pizza wasn't fun either, but Stumptown was really fun, and I thought that was for me. At some point, I started doing web design on the side there, and I did the Stumptown's first site, and mm-hmm. then eventually just that sort of became the full-time gig that I was doing. After I was fired a couple times.
What did you learn when you were working in coffee that you apply to business today?
Very little of what you would think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned that I should not be doing customer service or anything like that. Like I really wear my mood on my sleeve. I don't know if that's a term. So I learned a lot about myself, but mm-hmm. I learned a lot at Stumptown, and I guess from the other places, on how to run a business and how not to run a business. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the coffee houses I worked at was an early cyber cafe, and that was a bad idea. Cyber cafes were a bad idea because it was represented a misunderstanding of how the internet was going to work. Mm-hmm. It came from an era of when it was scarce and people didn't have a means to get on the internet, and so it was never going to take off. It was always just like the computers were a liability. And if you're going to open a coffee shop, you should be focused on the coffee. And I think I learned a lot from Stumptown because just kind of seeing how, like, Stumptown was the first place I worked where it was independent, yet the owner actually tried to give people health care and benefits and stuff like that. And I was always struck by the amount of loyalty people had. And so I think I learned a lot about, like, running a business and managing a business from Stumptown, from Dwayne. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did the books there for a while, so I learned how books work. And also that I shouldn't be doing books. I learned a lot about what not to do in life by working coffee, but I also learned a lot about business.
So who has inspired you the most in business?
Well, definitely Dwayne did. Mm-hmm. Do you mean people that I know or just people in general?
No. Are there people that you look up to?
You know, it's different right now I'm reading a book on Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. Randomly. I've read a lot of books on Steve Jobs. I read a book on Walt Disney. I thought that he's been kind of an inspiration. Like, it doesn't matter to me what a person is like on a personal level. It's more like I like reading about how they approach their unique business environment. Like, it's fascinating to me how Walt Disney built such a empire in his life from nothing. I always thought he was a better businessman than you would have thought, considering that he was always considered to be a person from a creative background. But all like Steve Jobs, like Walt Disney didn't really animate. It was kind of a means to an end. And like, you know, Steve Jobs, he never really knew how to program or anything. He would never do that kind of stuff. But on the same hand, it's fascinating how Bill Gates did program and did a lot of the early stuff at Microsoft. It's always just fascinating to me learn. So I guess those three people, maybe. I could think of a lot. I read a lot of business books, so the answer would change frequently.
So Need More, your business, mm-hmm. has grown quite a bit in the last year.
Yeah, look at Walt Disney.
How has your job changed from being... I mean, probably a year and a half ago, you were the main designer and programmer here at Need More. Mm-hmm. And now there are both designers and programmers that work with you. So how has your day-to-day changed?
You know, I used... if I had to put it in one word, I would say meetings. Mm-hmm. I used to think meetings were like horrible, awful things to be avoided. Mm-hmm. But I've kind of learned that, you know, it's just how you run a meeting. Like, you know, we're not, certainly not the kind of business that's going to get bogged down in half-day meetings where you have to have food trucked in and stuff. Like, meetings can just be a five-minute run into someone over on that side of the studio and have mm-hmm. a quick conversation. Like, I think a lot of it has been, the change for me has been, like not sitting at a desk for 8 solid hours and feeling like that's the limit of our throughput, but more like trying to delegate some things. And, you know, I really enjoy trying to hip more people to our aesthetic, maybe, or our philosophy. And I love when we have a meeting and there's like 6 people at the table and like just someone randomly has this idea that's like, oh my God, that's brilliant. Let's do mm-hmm. that. You know, I think just, I find it really exciting to have more minds contributing to projects and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, stuff.
stuff. So Need More is about to hit its first decade to the 10-year point. Mm. Where do you see yourself and your business in another 10 years?
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Older. Are you going to ask me anything about trains or anything? In 10 years older, probably richer.
Older and richer. Ray, why don't you tell me about trains?
Yeah, okay. To answer your question first seriously about where the in 10 years...
Hey, these are, you know, these are from the audience.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing them.
From Twitter.
Yeah.
I would like to take on projects that are bigger and deeper and more exciting and become more of a services business, because I feel like the one area we haven't really just dove into is what, you know, I don't know what it is yet. I think we kind of like, we dip our toes in the water in different kinds of services, but I strongly feel that to get Need More to the next level, we need to go deeper on some sort of service thing. I don't know if it's for clients or a different type of client, or if it's just a product that we're selling or a service that we're selling, but that's in the back of my mind, and I'm pretty sure it will be in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Trains.
Yeah. I mean, you've always had a fascination with trains.
Yeah. So, you know, that... It probably does go back to childhood, to that there was a railroad near our house. Mm-hmm. And I was always, you know, I mean, I imagine anyone would be. It's like, it was just this straight line that went in either direction. It was always like, where does it go? Like, all the roads, I could see the end of every road that was around, but there was like this railroad line, and I, you know... With the internet, I probably could figure out where it went, but I was always like, where does it go to the end of the world? You know, it just seemed like, where does this, you know, it's so straight and so long. And I just liked, it was always such a mysterious world. Like, you'd sit out there by the tracks and the sun would come out and you'd start to hear all these noises, like from the, I loved that. Which is why I decided after high school to hop trains for a while. Mm-hmm. Which I think I came into by accident, like...
The train hopping?
Yeah. Like, I think I... My friend Michelle was going to go on some... Going to go to Seattle hopping trains, and she backed out. But it was like, you always partnered up, so her partner needed someone else to go, or she wasn't going to go. So I was like, well, sure, I'll do it. I don't know why I was so eager to just... You know, like, I know, I recall at the time I had a job and was paying rent on a place, so probably a lot of people were pissed at me, but I just did it. And it was so cool. It was so fun. It almost killed me more than once, but it was like, my favorite thing was that you would go through... Like, if you're on a train, you don't see what's on the top or on the sides, really. You only see straight out the window. You can't see what's in front of the train or behind the train or over the train or anything like that. And when you're on the freeway driving in a car, you might be able to see all those things, but you're on a freeway. You're mostly seeing billboards, and there's a lot more. It's just dumbed down. It's not, you know, it's the freeway. It's not the train. So when you're hopping trains, you're completely exposed to the elements, for better or for worse. And you're going through these crazy old school tunnels through the Rocky Mountains that are like humans don't often set eyes on unless they're the actual train conductor. Like there's, you know, otherwise you don't really see them. And you go through, you know, a lot of these going through the mountains, and it was amazing. It was so amazing to see. Like, you could see why you'd want to be a train conductor because you get to see that kind of stuff all the time.
Yeah. You know, the closest I've ever come to feeling like that, I think, is driving through Yosemite. It's like, you know, just being underneath those huge expanses.
Yeah.
And of course, it was you that, you know, encouraged us to go there, too. So I think you're still...
Yeah, those experiences in are increasingly hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going to Yosemite is amazing. And, you know, I feel like we're starting to get our family to do that kind of stuff. But I'm not sure that I'll ever encourage my kids to hop trains, but certainly to go to Yosemite, I would.
Are there, besides train hopping, are there experiences that you've had that you would tell them, like, definitely they need to do this?
Well, yeah, but they're mostly, like, you know, traveling, places to see. I think... You know, I would be happy to do it with them. You know, like, I'd love to see Asia and I'd love to go back to Europe and stuff like that. You know, that, and honestly, part of me, you know, and I think every parent must go through this, and it bothers me a lot, is that, like, I feel bad letting, like, I know I watched a lot of TV as a kid, but I also hacked. I also learned to program. While I was still in elementary school and spent all of high school, like, fascinated with that kind of stuff. And I worry that in this age of iPhones and iPads, that it's sort of forcing people to be more of a consumer. And, you know, I feel like I might just sound like an old man when I say that, but at the same time, like I watched TV. There were a lot of TV shows that I really loved as a kid. But then when I was done with that, I would go into my basement and hack on the computer. And I would learn all of these crazy things and just figure stuff out and stuff. And I feel like I don't want my kids to grow up like watching TV and then saying, oh, relax by playing on the iPad, which is also mindless and doesn't involve any sort of logic or thinking or reasoning or, you know, discovery.
I just want to make sure...
Yeah. Oh, maybe it does.
Yeah. Well, maybe that you just found the service you need to provide. It definitely seems like you can use the iPad for discovery if the right tools are there. Yeah.
That's true. I definitely would love for my kids to have creative outlets like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's learning to play music or whatever, you know, but I suppose kids are going to do that.
Yeah. One other question from someone in the studio. have there been any times or moments that you think have made you who you are today? Like, what have been, like, the really pivotal moments for you?
I was kind of alluding to that when I said leaving the Twin Cities. I was sort of like, I think sometimes a person, however talented and intelligent and well-meaning, can get involved in stuff like drugs, and not the good kind, and kind of go-nowhere jobs that really aren't using the parts of their brain that they should be using. And I was seeing a lot of people going down that path, and, you know, have learned since that most of them did. And I think I saw that kind of happening, being in the, you know, like, the Twin Cities can be really, really fucking depressing. Like, in the winter, we were not really getting enough daylight, and you can't really get any exercise, and you're probably not eating well because you're just serving coffee. like, I kind of felt like I needed to leave there to save my life.
Mm-hmm.
And during the, like, marathon drive to Portland, because I first came to Portland and then went to Santa Cruz. During this sort of marathon drive to Portland, I fell asleep at the wheel and rolled the car like four times and totaled it. And I feel like that was like this, that was like the darkest hour. And like, I think back on that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Not just when I'm driving at night, but a lot when I think about, you know, like, I think everyone has, should have a moment where they like almost die.
Yeah.
I've had a couple.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've had more than one of those.
Had a couple.
Yeah.
In the course of hopping trains, I was hit by a train. I almost drowned as a kid. I got electrocuted on top of a ladder as a kid, which I flew through the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, and other.
Mm-hmm.
I've been hit by a car as well as totaling a car. I just
You and I were walking on like a snowy day.
Oh yeah,
and
we almost died that one time too.
Car came hurtling towards us. Thank God for that tree. I mean, you're surviving all this for something, right? So
exactly. And you know, I definitely have had a much healthier attitude since leaving the Twin Cities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Well, I also thought I was going to die of cancer. I mean, there was that. There was the lung cancer scare.
Right.
Like, how many? I should really make a list of these at some point. But yeah, see, that was the thing that I think we'd both tried to quit smoking. And I was misdiagnosed with lung cancer after an x-ray once, and that definitely, like, we were talking about this last night, like, there were some other people in the room who were like, you know, I wouldn't mind a cigarette. Oh, it's kind of hard to quit. I was like, it was not hard to quit.
Yeah.
Like, I could smoke a cigarette and not enjoy it. Like, I just, there's nothing about me that wants a cigarette. I'll do it, like, to, like, make everyone feel comfortable or whatever, but like, I don't want a cigarette. I don't like, you know, things like that. Like, you know, same with like some of the drugs that I used to do in the Midwest. Like, I just have no interest in any of that stuff, you know? Like, I'm grateful for all of that because now my interests are healthy, like having kids and being a good example and like running a business and like, you know, doing good by my people here and, you know, like, trying to do good work, trying to do the best work possible, and like trying to really, you know, run the kind of business that I'm proud of and that I would, you know, that, you know, like I might be, I think like, sometimes I think about what like that 20-year-old train hopping shithead would think about me now. First of all, I would think he was a shithead. But I would be curious of what he thought of me now, and I would think, yeah, he would actually probably think I was a dick, but once he heard, like, what I was doing and stuff, he would probably really want to work here, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that...
So you want to be the man that 20-year-old...
Wouldn't mind
jerk.
Growing up to be, or, like, wouldn't mind working with, or would think was, you know, pretty cool for a grown-up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, then.
Are there any other questions?
You know, and I know that this is... Yes, there is.
Okay.
So, we've been in this business for about, you know, over
almost
10 years.
Almost 10 years, yeah.
Web design. What would you say to someone that's, you know, trying to get in right now? What advice would you give them? Go
into,
to college?
Into web design?
Yeah. It's,
I don't know that I would give them any advice. I would probably ask them why the hell they would want to do that. And if they're sure. And to justify it to me. And to ask if they'd considered other options. But if they were very serious about it, I would say, well, you know, Are they getting an, are they trying to start a business? Or are they trying to work at a business? Are they trying to, like, I mean, as far as like getting the skills to do the work, I'm not the right person to ask because I didn't go to college and I have no formal training in any of this, not one bit in any of it. And I'm doing okay. But I'd say everyone learns different, you know, like, despite the fact that I didn't go to college, I have this ability to just sit down and like read through a technical book front to back in a couple of days if it's something that genuinely interests me. I think all that really matters is that you are interested in it, you're passionate about it, and you're willing to like tinker. Like, you, it doesn't matter if you've opened up a text editor or, you know, a photo editor or whatever. Like, if you're really interested, you'll right click on something in your web browser and you'll say inspect element, and you'll try to figure out what's happening there. Like, you, if you have genuine interest in it, you'll know. It'll be the thing that keeps you up at night. And if you don't, then some little punk who does is always going to do better and work faster and more creatively and figure things out and be willing to work evenings and weekends because it's fun. And if you're the kind of person who's just like, well, I need a job, so maybe it should be this, I don't know, then screw it, you shouldn't be doing it. I think that applies to anything. I don't feel like there's anything special or unique about this. It's just, if this particular thing is exciting to you, you know, then go for it. We're hiring. We're not really, but I just always say that.
Last question.
Yes.
What is on your turntable right now? What are you listening to?
Well, it's funny you should ask that because immediately following this segment on the program, I'm going to tell you about something that I'm listening to. But I would say that, setting that aside, I've really been into New Zealand music. The Bats, The Clean, and this David Kilgore guy has this some solo stuff that I've really been listening to a lot. And also, Grant Hart has this amazing new album out. He's the ex-drummer from Husker Du. He has this amazing album out that started out as a collaboration with William S. Burroughs. William S. fucking Burroughs. The Naked Lunch guy.
Yeah.
So, and apparently, like, he started it, like, obviously when Burroughs was alive, but like 10, 15 years ago. And like,
only you had your Burroughs BBS up now.
Yeah, like, to talk about. Oh, it would be on the front page of my BBS. Yeah, so yeah, the new Grant Hart, not so new David Kilgore, definitely.
Nice.
And the second album by Belle and Sebastian. The one that starts out with Stars of Track and Field. I can't get enough of that album. It's a masterpiece.
Well, gosh, Ray, thanks for coming in.
Hey, it's been real nice. It's been a pleasure.
I'm walking, here's the thing, and I'm talking. When you and me, I'm hoping that you come back to me. I'm hoping that you come back to me. What you gonna do when the well run dry? You gonna run away and hide? I'm gonna run right by your side. For you, pretty baby, I'll even die. I'm walking. Yes, indeed, I'm talking.
So, Antoine Dominique Jr.
Antoine Dominique Jr. One of New Orleans' best.
Yeah. AKA Fats Domino. He is a New Orleans man. Is born there, and he will almost certainly die there. He was thought to have died there. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, during
about
Katrina.
The Katrina thing. Yeah, I vaguely now remember hearing that. But
yeah, someone had like spray painted "Rest in Peace, Fats, You'll Be Missed" or something.
Yeah,
and
he was not dead.
They had been airlifted out or something.
So my pick this week was "I'm Walking" by Fats Domino. I was watching a part of the Blues Brothers the other night, Sometimes I just put on random things while I'm kind of working or reading. Usually things that are kind of music heavy. And that song came out, I was like, I love this song. This song is so good. It is barely 2 minutes long. It's like 2 minutes, 8 seconds or something. We could round to 2 minutes. And it is a gem. It is so, like, the beat is so driving, and it's so, like, perfect and restrained. And, I mean, I love it. What do you think of this song?
I feel similarly. I like the beginning, like just those first couple bars with just the beat. It's just like, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, why hasn't this been sampled by everybody? Like, it's such like a jumpy rhythm too. Yeah. Like it's
very upbeat kind of, you know, I listened through, basically there's a collection of like all of his hit singles that were on Imperial, basically the '50s.
Mm-hmm.
The man had a lot of hits.
Yeah, I was looking at Wikipedia. This was like his like fourth number one in a row, and fourth like crossover number one in a row or something.
Yeah, but the thing is, okay, so he didn't actually ever have a number one on.
Or maybe
it
was his like fourth gold record in a row or something.
Right, they were all big sellers, but like there was sort of this artificial, like he was on the R&B charts where he was getting all the number ones, but on the pop charts, which was like, you know, the white charts, mm-hmm, in the 50s, he like Blueberry Hill made it to number 2, you know, and that was the highest charting. This made it to like number 4.
It's like the highest selling record of its time.
Yeah. I mean, of course it wasn't. His first single in 1950 sold like a million copies. I mean, like I think he sold second only to Elvis in like pre-Beatles. Man sold a lot of records. It's crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah, he had 5 gold records before 1955. I mean, that's crazy to think of. Like this track was 57, and he'd already had like Blueberry. I mean, this is such a good track. It's like there's what I like is that there's only 2 drum fills, and it's just like, you know, like there's nothing fancy there. It's like, it's almost like the signature of the song is almost that guitar part.
There's a sax solo too, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The sax solo is delightfully skittish. It's just like, you know, like.
I normally like sax solos. Not the best thing in the world. It's like on a rock and roll-ish song, even oldie. But this one, I was like, it's kind of delightful.
Yes.
It's
a good... Yes, I felt exactly the same way. I'm typically like, not a fan of the sax solo. Yeah, but this is like, it's got a nice sensibility. It's kind of on the backbeat. Like, it's kind of off the beat. It's really underplayed, kind of like almost like scatting around the beat. In the same way that his vocal line kind of does, you know? Like, he rarely sings something on the quarter note, right on the he'll end the whole verse on the beat, but the rest of it is like just precedes the beat. So it really kind of lends to like the feeling of driving the song along. And that guitar part is what I always think of as being the melody, that do 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 do, but really that's a rhythm part. It's like you can't really hear the bass much, but it would be the bass part, really. You'd think of it as the bass part. It's not really a melody. It's just kind of like it was probably never written. It was just sort of played in the studio. Like, play something, guitarist kind of thing, you know? Like, I know he kind of had this band that he always played with back then. So they were probably just really, like, they'd probably been playing the song already live or something, you know? They'd probably already kind of, but yeah. So catchy. I just can't stop listening to that song. It's so, and it's in the Blues Brothers. It's the perfect part. It's when like the kids all go to hang up the posters for the show.
Okay.
So there's suddenly all this action, like kids run around, hang up the posters. It's like, I'm walking. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So it's delightful. And I was surprised how much of his stuff I really liked, you know, it's like, it's all so catchy. There's so many. There's like a lot of other tracks that are almost as good as I'm Walking.
Yeah, I was thinking about this when I was listening to this on repeat, mm-hmm. and then listening through the like greatest hits album that I got or whatever. Mm-hmm. We listened to that one Chuck Berry,
right?
Greatest hits or one Chuck Berry album
mm-hmm.
when we were doing the book,
mm-hmm.
whatever that book. And I had a response where I was like, yeah, I recognize Chuck Berry as being like one of the fathers here, but like not really enjoying it as much as I know or I perhaps should. But this, I was having the opposite response. I was just like, I am loving this.
Right.
Like, why isn't this going into my ear holes all the time?
Well, I thought it was perfect too after your pick last week, because it was kind of like in the same era.
Just stepping back a few years.
Yeah.
Not too far either.
Right. Yeah. That's funny. They have a picture in here of the graffiti on his house. Yeah, that's crazy. He recorded a long time after that, but, you know, it was kind of like they said that basically in the 60s, they kind of switched his producer up and kind of changed the sound up to kind of make it sound a little more commercial, which is ridiculous because, like, this guy's had so many hits. Like, you don't fuck with that formula, you idiots. Why would you do that? This is fucking Fats Domino, man. Like, I had no idea how many hits he had.
Making it more commercial? Like, just radio friendly, kind of? Or
yeah. Yeah. Like, backing singers and kind of.
Gotcha. Just adding layers of production just because.
Right. Exactly.
That always ends well.
And it was kind of like the combination of that and, you know, like in the, yeah, I think the British invasion was kind of the line in the sand. It was like anyone who was having hits before that was no longer having hits, it seems, you know. But yeah, I realized he was in two movies. He was in Shake, Rattle, and Rock, and The Girl Can't Help It, both of which I now want to see.
The Girl Can't Help It sounds familiar. What is that?
I think there was a song. Maybe he did the song. I don't know, mm-hmm. but I know that I've heard that song. It's a musical comedy from 1956.
Oh, it's Jane Mansfield.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think this is one of the movies that was in a constant loop on my grandmother's television set. She loved like mid-century musicals.
Huh.
Like musical comedies, I'm pretty
sure. CinemaScope.
That's why it's just like hovering in the back of my head. Yeah.
Oh yeah, well he is listed at number one under the rock and roll star section of the poster.
There's all sorts of people in that movie.
Yeah.
The Platters, Little Richard, Gene Vincent.
Yeah, I think we got to see that movie.
Yeah. A down-and-out gangster hires an alcoholic press agent to make his blonde bombshell girlfriend a recording star in 6 weeks. It's perfect. Why not? There's a lot of adjectives in that sentence.
Yeah, so, yeah. Antoine, you know, his first language was Creole?
I saw that.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
He does have a sort of a unique style of singing. And, man, a winning smile. We were mentioning that last night. That smile.
He wears a suit well.
Yeah.
It's a good smile. That pretty sweet flat top, like, early days.
Right. Right. Like, it's concave, yeah. That flat top. Like, almost, yeah. I wonder why. Is that like his thing? His trademark? You trying to look like a domino? I wonder where the nickname came from, Fats Domino. But back then, it's like everyone had nicknames, right? I mean, even when they talk about their band, it's like Alvin Red Tyler. Like,
we need nicknames.
I remember in this early Saturday Night Live, like, I think it was Saturday Night Live or... Yeah, where, like, in the credits, like, everyone had the nickname Bud. Like, even the women. It's like, Bud in quotes. It's like... Anyway. Anything else we should talk about?
Not that I know of.
Okay. I don't even have the time on here. Okay.
Yeah, it's getting late in the day.
Yeah. I'm pretty much... My daughter was home sick this morning, as you know, but the listeners don't. And so I stayed home with her, having to listen to, like, PBS kids shows all morning.
Not just a constant stream of My Little Pony?
No. I didn't...
Switching it up?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm so sick of that. Like, they're so sick of that money.
I've been getting nothing but Busy Town Mysteries for the last, like, several weeks. Which...
I would welcome Busy Town Mysteries. We had some Elmo, though. Like, that will drive a man insane. I was like, okay, Pony's going back on.
That was impressive.
Thanks. I couldn't think of what Elmo would actually say. But I know that he would start it by saying,
Elmo says.
You know, because he always speaks when they... What do you call it? Like third person or...
Yeah.
Third person, fourth person.
The Ricky Henderson thing.
Ricky
Henderson. He was a baseball player.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Popular in the 80s and 90s.
Okay.
Stole a lot of bases, played for the Oakland A's and the Yankees.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's cool.
Notorious for referring to himself in the third person. Like, early. Perhaps an early
practice.
It's like a
practice. Sports figures always do that.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think that's meant to scare people. Like, they're talking with God or something about themselves. I don't know what the thing is there to psych people out. Like, you know, didn't Muhammad Ali do that? No, he spoke in rhyme, right?
Yeah.
Which also cool.
That is cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Muhammad Ali is inherently cool. Yeah. You're just not gonna take anything away from him.